Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features part two of a conversation between Aaron and Don Rassler. Don is an assistant professor in the Department of Social Sciences and the director of strategic initiatives at the Combating Terrorism Center at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point.
In part one of our conversation, Don and I discussed his article for the CTC Sentinel called Situating the Emergence of the Islamic State of Khorasan, which came out in mid to late March. In part two of the conversation, we talked about what has happened since then, as well as what that's meant for the Afghan Taliban, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, Al-Qaeda Central, as well as how this is playing out with U.S. policy in Afghanistan and the Afghan peace process.
At the end of the interview, we're also going to have a new edition of our hashtag social media segment, so make sure you stick around for that. And also, if you haven't caught part one of the interview yet, there's links to it in the show notes, so you can listen to that.
One of the interesting things I think we've probably noticed since your article came out about 4 months ago is that, you know, up until then, a lot of this stuff was maybe more symbolic or rhetorical and in words, but we've seen more active military activities from Wilayat Khorasan, as well as them instituting some forms of justice against spies, according to them, as well as even having a couple of dawah events. Additionally, it also appears that the Afghan Taliban is becoming more concerned with it, putting out overt and thinly veiled messages, including the annual Eid al-Fitr message from Mullah Omar today. What's sort of been going on from your perspective over the last 4 months? Have we seen more bayat? Obviously, we've seen infighting now between the Islamic State and the Afghan Taliban as well. Could you give the listeners a little bit more granular view on this?
Sure. So over the last several months, we haven't necessarily seen there have been what I would characterize as unconfirmed rumors of bayat in terms of additional people joining the Islamic State, particularly for, some Afghan commanders. But it isn't entirely clear if those people have actually switched allegiances. And you've actually had, one really fascinating case where, similar to what we're seeing with people joining the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, is you have, some individuals like the English rapper who went over and one of the early British foreign fighters to join the Islamic State and is now supposedly on the run in Turkey because he was, decided that the Islamic State didn't represent, what it claimed to be. One interesting case with the Islamic State of Khorasan is that you had a guy named Saadat Emirati, who we talked about before, who was a commander for the Taliban in Logar province. And what was interesting is that, so he left the Taliban, went to the Islamic State, and, after that, spent some time with the Islamic State and supposedly decided to defect from the Islamic State and go back to the Taliban. And what ended up happening, reportedly, if you're to believe the Islamic State's media, is that they ended up decapitating Saadat Emirati. So it sort of shows the brutality of the Islamic State in terms of defectors, but also that they've, taken a noteworthy Taliban commander and then beheaded him, which is actually a significant event. So there's that issue of, people who decided to join who have left, rumors of some other people joining, which are unconfirmed. To be honest, it seems as though the Islamic State has struggled a little bit to bring in additional members. They have been primarily active in Jalalabad in Afghanistan, which actually, if you think about it, really isn't that surprising because all of the areas on the Pakistani side of the border where from which their primary push of the recognized the TTP commanders, the areas that they controlled, were all on the other, directly on the opposite side of the border. So if you were to think maybe the area that they're most comfortable with, or to make a strategic play in terms of trying to gain influence, you know, where the Khyber Pass goes through and the transit hub, maybe thinking about financing and resources, it actually seems like a relatively smart play for the Islamic State to make a push in that area. And so they've been active in Jalalabad seeking to take over territory. They've made claims that, you know, one entire village in Jalalabad has decided to come to their side. They make claims of conducting attacks in Jalalabad. You know, they've been in fights with the Taliban in Jalalabad as well, supposedly in one case reportedly beheading 10 Taliban members that they had fought with. They've lost some of their personnel through these exchanges. So that's sort of on the territory and their main area over the last several months of strategic focus in terms of their operations. What we also see is that there have been some speculation and also unclear reports about them, the Islamic State, conducting attacks in other areas. There's a, you know, perhaps the most noteworthy case is the rumors and back and forth, you know, claims about whether or not the Islamic State in Khorasan was the entity that conducted an attack in April against a bank in Jalalabad, which the Taliban had attacked several years previously. It's unclear as to whether or not the Islamic State actually conducted that attack. The Islamic State has also made claims that they killed a Taliban shadow governor for Nangarhar, which again leads to their strategic play or emphasis on trying to gain additional ground in Jalalabad. You know, there are other rumors about the Islamic State having kidnapped Hazaras, which has since mostly seems to have been dispelled, and that people are now blaming that on the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. So there's a bunch of different issues where, you know, you have these incidents. It's not really clear that the Islamic State is being that active, you know, and mostly it seems like what they're doing recently is actually getting in fights with the Taliban in Nangarhar. The one additional case that I would point to that I think is, you know, also deserves, you know, additional scrutiny is the attack in May of a bus carrying Ismailis in near Karachi, where 43 Ismailis were killed. There were reports that through the Pakistani media that on the scene that there were leaflets that were left that were claiming this attack on, you know, on behalf of the Islamic State. There was also a commission that was set up in Pakistan to look into the attack. And some of the preliminary conclusions of that commission was that it was is leading them to believe that it was the Islamic State. You know, there were three different parties that or organizations that claim responsibility for that attack: Jundullah, Fazlullah's TTP, and the Islamic State. So it's not entirely clear who exactly conducted the attack. You know, the benefit of the Islamic State is that I guess it has led people to believe that they were, you know, potentially the entity that conducted the attack. So leading some additional credence maybe to some of their operational activity or gains in Pakistan. So that's on the operational side. Then, you know, there's also been a lot of activity over the last several months, you know, since I've written the article, on the back and forth sort of in the ideological domain about, you know, both the Afghan Taliban and the Islamic State, and the Islamic State and the Pakistani Taliban, you know, issuing a war of words between each other. You know, you mentioned Mullah Omar's Eid message, which directly targets the Islamic State in terms of their credibility, you know, basically calling for Mullah Omar calling for unity, you know, basically saying that we have you know, through the Eid message as well as through a statement that the Taliban's deputy Mansour released, where he was, you know, basically telling the Islamic State that, you know, we need to be unified. We've been here before. We need to get along. We're stronger together. You know, which are hard lessons that the Afghan Mujahideen and the Taliban learned from the 1990s. You know, there's also in May there was the release from the Pakistani Taliban of the attack on the process used to nominate and install Baghdadi, as well as the territory, you know, controlled by the Islamic State as well. So essentially you have had in recent months the Islamic State being, you know, pushed back on in public fashion through central message and strategic messages from the Afghan Taliban and their leadership, as well as from the Pakistani Taliban's leadership. What's interesting is, you know, you have the Beak 10, which was also released recently, you know, has an article about the dispute, you know, where there's a, you know, anonymous person who has asked a question from the Taliban about, you know, the legitimacy, you know, between, you know, if someone's pledged bayah to Mullah Omar, you know, are they, you know, are they allowed to renege on their pledge, or what does their pledge mean with respect to the creation of an institution of the caliph and the caliphate? And so in Dabiq 10, you know, they walk the readers through the process of, you know, essentially describing the Taliban and Mullah Omar as sort of a regional regime with regional ambitions to basically discredit the Afghan Taliban. And all of this just is the back and forth between both of these entities, well, the collection of these entities, all really vying for ownership of a particular jihad. And really, you know, looking at this from a strategic perspective, I think that that's what ISK, Afghan Taliban, and TTP, they're all fighting for. And that's really what's at stake. And in my personal opinion, I think that's the dangerous issue for the Afghan Taliban, is that while the Islamic State in Khorasan isn't that powerful necessarily, they have really started to introduce seeds of doubt within that landscape in Afghanistan and Pakistan and the jihadi landscape regarding the status of Mullah Omar, his authority, his ability to lead. Which, to be honest with you, I think is surprising that other entities have not raised those issues more forcefully before.
Yeah, related to that, you know, something that I've thought about that we've seen in other areas in terms of sort of the broader IS and AQ issues is sort of a generational divide in some respects. And one of the arguments that the Islamic State has been talking about related to Mullah Omar as well, and even the IMU, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, said this in relation to why they pledged bayat to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is, you know, we haven't seen any proof of you being alive in, what has it been, 13, 14, 15 years now in regard to Mullah Omar. And as a result, because of this, they hope to sort of try and maybe bring people over, because this brings up skepticism related to whether he's actually alive or not. But also the fact that, you know, many of the kids that have grown up over the last decade or so, they weren't around during the era when the Taliban was actually in power. So I was wondering whether you thought that was possibly something that could appeal to younger, more militant Islamists within the Afghan landscape.
I think so, yes. I would agree that, you know, this dynamic of the old guard versus the new guard, or the old generation versus the new generation, particularly as it pertains to not just the leadership of Mullah Omar, but, you know, and the dynamics associated with him, but also about issues related to technology, how people consume information. And while the Taliban, you know, has been, at least during the 2000s and over the last decade, been good about getting messages out and being at the forefront of, you know, publishing things in multiple languages, being very active and You know, recognizing that sometimes being first to the truth, you know, first to the message, you know, helps to define the truth and or the people's perception of the truth and those sorts of things. So I definitely think that that's a big factor. You know, I also think related to this is that I think there's also an issue of what might be characterized as Taliban fatigue. And so I think you have a combination of, you know, younger individuals who are, you know, want to see change. They look at a place like, you know, Iraq and Syria, and they say, hey, well, look, why can't we do this here? What are we doing wrong? And then maybe they look and they say, all right, well, you know, the Taliban, what have you done for us lately? So yes, they've been fighting a long fight, and they've been committed and resilient. But really, what has the Taliban achieved? Okay, yes, they, you know, do have control over large areas of rural Afghanistan and sympathies and you know, and sway in certain towns and are able to impact things in certain cities in Afghanistan. But yet, you know, the Afghan government still remains in power and looks like it will continue to remain in power for the foreseeable, you know, or at least over the short term. And so you have this issue about, you know, people looking at the Taliban and not necessarily seeing progress. And so I think that also feeds into this issue of, you know, doubts about, you know, who the leader, you know, the Mir of the Faithful is and what he's up to. And to be entirely honest with you, you know, I'm someone who studies these movements, and it's also a concern that I have, you know, where you have a leader who hasn't really shown his face, particularly when you have somebody like Baghdadi, you know, with his some of his high profile, at least last year, media things that he did, as well as statements that the Islamic State has done. You know, and I think that it will be interesting to see how the Taliban adapts to this, particularly as it relates to their media. So will they privilege trying to tell stories of local fighters or foreigners and giving voice similar to the how the Islamic State does things? Are they going to try and change how they communicate on Twitter and build different followings and mirror some of what has worked for the Islamic State? It's actually something that I've been surprised that the Islamic State in Khorasan hasn't done more of. I would have thought that they would have sort of ramped up their media and the sophistication and attractiveness of their videos, because that would be, you would think, be an easier way for them to gain additional support for their cause amongst, you know, the community of people that you mentioned, young people who are maybe out of, you know, feel out of touch with the Taliban and more in touch with an entity that knows how to speak to them and represents something different.
So related to that, you know, even though the Islamic State does have a presence in some areas of Afghanistan, do you think it's generally possible that they could carve out a space for themselves and whether they were a viable entity in the region? Obviously, there have been a number of drone strikes on their leaders, including the leader himself only a few days ago, as well as the current infighting with the Afghan Taliban, which I imagine is still far stronger in many respects. And as you noted, many of the leaders were actually from the TTP and not necessarily Afghans. So would it become more of a Pakistani movement, or do you think that they really could potentially maybe carve out some space inside of Afghanistan and take over territory and then try and, you know, govern it or do the governance that we've already seen them trying to attempt to do in areas outside of Syria and Iraq, like in Libya, for example?
I think that the Islamic State in Khorasan, I don't, at least over the short term, and perhaps the midterm, I think the conditions are different in Afghanistan currently than they are, very much different than they are in a place like Libya or in Iraq and Syria or some of the areas where the Islamic State has made further grounds and has actually governed and set up institutional structures. So, you know, the Islamic State has been active primarily in, at least from what we've been able to see and discern, in Nangarhar province. They are, you know, do report to have a presence, albeit potentially small, in other areas of the country, as well as certain areas in Pakistan. I don't think my opinion is that I don't think the Islamic State would face significant challenges in actually being able to govern in the way or scale that the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria does, because you have, you know, on the Afghan side of the border and at, you know, the Afghan National Army and security forces, which are, you know, we could debate about their capabilities. But I think one thing you can say is that they are more committed, have shown to be more committed to the fight than some of the Iraqi units that are fighting the Islamic State. And, you know, that's naturally due to some sectarian issues, you know, in Iraq particularly, which, you know, yes, there are sectarian issues in Afghanistan, but I think that the security forces in Afghanistan are a bit more committed and a bit more capable to remove the threat. You also have actually a confluence of interest between the Afghan Taliban and potentially the security forces themselves to actually get rid of the Islamic State. So, you know, another factor that we don't know, you know, about these, you know, the strikes that you mentioned, potentially, well, killing Shahidullah Shahid, the, you know, defected TTP spokesman who was the spokesperson for the Islamic State in Khorasan, and as well as claims that, you know, at least unconfirmed at this point, from what I'm seeing, about Hafiz Khan Saeed and his potential death in a drone strike in Nangarhar province in Afghanistan, is that, you know, whether or not the Taliban, you know, provided information or people sympathetic to the Taliban, you know, or these strikes were conducted based upon the information gleaned from the Afghan security forces, you know, in combination with the U.S., you know, I obviously don't know the answer to that question. But one nice way to get rid of your rivals is to provide information about them. And the Taliban has been in these, you know, in these, particularly in Nangarhar and eastern Afghanistan, long enough to be able to have a network that, you know, I would imagine that they would be positioned to provide that type of information if they wanted to, particularly if they're fighting some of these individuals. I think it's unlikely that the Islamic State in Khorasan will be able to significantly control a sizable area and to actually hold that territory and to govern it. Another issue that I would think about would be, and I wouldn't necessarily suggest that this might be the Islamic State in Khorasan doing this, but another sort of wild card factor that I've long thought about is, you know, is there another party that potentially emerges that shows an ability, maybe in a place like, you know, in the upper reaches of northeastern Afghanistan and Kunar Nuristan, to, you know, where there was a certain period of time, a Salafi state that was set up in that part of the region. You know, is there an entity that's able to set up some sort of, quote, state or institutional sort of, you know, governing mechanisms in that region, mirrored on historical precedent, that, you know, to me, it seems like it might be more likely that something like that would happen, rather than the Islamic State actually setting up shop from a governance perspective. That isn't to say that the Islamic State, you know, in Khorasan might not try to do that from a public relations perspective. But to actually be able to sustain that, I'm very skeptical of.
Yeah, definitely. You know, zooming out a little bit, I alluded to the group a little bit earlier. How does the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan play into all of this? Since it also has pledged bayat to Baghdadi, though it's still unrecognized, and they've always been one of, if not the strongest, of the foreign national groups in the AFPAC region. How do you see them playing out in this? Because historically they've been pretty close to the Afghan Taliban too, but it seems like they're drifting more towards the Islamic State now.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that from what I've seen, that they are drifting more towards the Islamic State. You know, and what it will be interesting is to see how the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan positions itself, you know, given the recent strikes against the Islamic State and Khorasan's leadership, Shahidullah Shahid and others, potentially even Hafiz Khan Saeed, you know, and if it is the case that he has actually been removed from the scene, who potentially replaces those guys? And what does that mean for the response of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan? Now, what's interesting about that case is that, you know, I would actually describe the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan as being a group that, while yes, they are siding more in the IS camp, they, as you noted, have had a historical, you know, and in some cases quite strong relationship with the Afghan Taliban. And the way I would characterize them is that they're actually a group that's hedging their bets and sort of also playing the middle. So while, yes, Usman Ghazi, the leader of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, has pledged support for the Islamic State and a faction of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan through a video that was released that was branded by the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan's media outlet, publicly declared formal bay'ah to the Islamic State. It's still unclear, at least from where I sit, as to whether or not that represents the organization as a whole, or is that just that one faction, which was reportedly operating in the northern part of Afghanistan. You know, what's also interesting about the IMU case is that, you know, they've shown themselves to be survivors. And so, you know, throughout the 2000s, they bounced around from, you know, in the initial days, being in the north of Afghanistan, bouncing down to Zabul province, you know, in the mid 2000s, also, you know, being in South Waziristan and other areas of the Fatah, being active with some of the campaigns in Swat with the TTP in terms of some of their activity to actually try and implement Sharia and govern. And so, you know, and then also what's confusing about the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan is that it seems as though it's unclear as to, while they talk about, you know, the need to conduct jihad in Central Asia to fight, you know, the Pakistani government, it's actually unclear as to who, from a priority perspective, their real enemy is. So, you know, if you look at what they've done operationally, they're kind of, it seems as though, in two main camps in the region. And so you have units, or at least people who are believed to be IMU members, who have acted as a force multiplication effect and sort of ground foot soldiers for strategic TTP attacks against strategic targets like airports and Pakistani military facilities, which they've actually been quite successful at. And so there's a camp that's focused on attacking the Pakistani state, and, you know, previous IMU leaders have articulated that that's their focus and that's what they want to do. You also have a component of the IMU that is in northern Afghanistan that is playing a you know, and has played over the last several years a role in that area, primarily because of the different, you know, that particular part of Afghanistan being more because of its proximity to Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, and the ethnic composition of that area being more favorable to, you know, members of the, you know, the IMU. And so, yes, they are siding, you know, more with IS. But what exactly that means, and if that actually means anything substantive, at this point, I would say my perspective is that that's somewhat unclear. You know, if the Islamic State was looking to bolster their membership, particularly in the face of losses, you know, that they've recently had over the last week, as well as over the last several months in terms of some of the members, you know, the IMU might be an attractive target to try and formally bring into the fold, and to try and recruit them to do so.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see on that front, at least. Now, one of the other groups, which, you know, if this was maybe like 10 years ago, we'd be talking about the whole time, that we haven't talked about at all, is where does this place Al-Qaeda then? You know, this is the historical spot where Al-Qaeda Central, at least, has been based, and yet they seem like they're not really much of a player. Of course, there have been cases of these attacks in Bangladesh recently, and of course, you know, this Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent formation that they've established. But beyond that, you know, in sort of more of the classical areas where they've been based in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where do they fit into all of this? And has there been any reactions at all from them really to all these sort of fast moving dynamics?
Al-Qaeda, you know, has actually been fairly silent on these issues. And so what has been interesting is you have seen, particularly what drew my attention was the TTP statement, where they're pushing back against, you know, trying to discredit Baghdadi and his position as the caliph, as well as, you know, their control over territory in Iraq and Syria, is that they openly, you know, and the Afghan Taliban did the same thing with, you know, with Al-Qaeda, and sort of acknowledge them as an entity that that they're partnered with. You also, you know, there's an interesting, and so we get glimpses of this in terms of Al-Qaeda's positioning. You know, and it's actually hard to know exactly what Al-Qaeda's role is for a number of reasons, you know, because we have to rely on what it is that they release, or how we can discern this through reading the media statements of other groups, or what other sort of reporting is out there. You know, I think what's been interesting is that for Al-Qaeda, you know, they've in the region, you could argue that, you know, and you know, we could obviously debate about, you know, their this significance of what operational presence they still have or capability they still have in the region, which actually has been diminished. But that being said, you know, Al-Qaeda has played, it seems that they played the long game in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and particularly in Pakistan in particular, where they've always, you know, over the last two decades, tried to advise other groups, to try and be helpful, to try and facilitate, to try and shape their narratives about jihad, whether that's about the jihad in Afghanistan and the priority that that should be given, or the jihad in Kashmir. And so, you know, you have Al-Qaeda having this long-term presence in the region, and also early efforts that the group made in 2007, 2008 to release, you know, a variety of media, make a focus on releasing Urdu language videos, and to make connections with, or actually maybe perhaps solidify some of their connections with the Punjabi jihadi outfits, to sort of expand you know, their capabilities, or just to advise some of these groups. I think that you could make the case that while Al-Qaeda core, you know, led by, you know, Ayman al-Zawahiri in Pakistan, doesn't necessarily have a strong operational presence in that region, is that they still have influence. And I think that, you know, there's a variety of reasons for this. One is the one I just mentioned about them investing in trying to you know, build, and, you know, through their vanguard of how they identified themselves from the early days of, you know, creating this community of organizations that buy into a similar cause. And I think that their influence is reflected in the ideological hybridization between how some of these organizations are describing their fight, the conflation of the near and far enemy for many of these Pakistani groups. You know, it's also because, you know, at least, you know, perhaps maybe less so now, but over the last, you know, decade plus, Al-Qaeda members had died on the battlefield with some of these guys. And so that those things might actually go a long way as well in terms of people's memories and their allegiances. And so, you know, you have this group like the Islamic State that's being a, you know, is trying to stir the pot and be a spoiling agent and divisive figure within this community, where Al-Qaeda has actually tried to do the opposite. And what's actually shocking is that you have an entity, you know, it's funny you mentioned, you know, 10 years ago, we'd have been talking about Al-Qaeda all the time. Al-Qaeda has actually emerged in the region as an entity that is viewed as being, or at least projects itself as being and wants to identify itself as being an entity that's a bit more principled and holds to its principles more so than the Islamic State. And that's actually one of the things that, you know, where you see, and this is reflected in the TTP's statement that they issued against Baghdadi and the Islamic State about, some of what they, of their defense in terms of the targets that the Islamic State goes after, you know, are the same targets that, you know, several years ago, and you could make a case even today that they target in terms of civilians and sectarian targets, but yet they make this case that also it's about these, about principles, you know, when it comes to who's a legitimate civilian, who's not. And so I think that that's an issue that's interesting in this dynamic, which is also, you know, I think tied to at least the old guard or the established groups in the region, maybe perhaps being a bit more afraid of the divisiveness of, what happened in the 1990s and trying to keep things together, which is very hard to do given the multiplicity of agendas and the multiple jihadi preferences in the region, but be able to do so to the extent that they can. And it seems as though that several of these groups view Al-Qaeda as being an agent that is more driven by, yes, there's differences, but to try and bring some collectiveness to things rather than trying to change the game entirely. And so it's been surprising to me that some of these groups, particularly the TTP, have actually come out to openly defend Al-Qaeda when they could easily take a different position.
Yeah, especially in light of, you know, some of the messages that were released after the raid against bin Laden and, you know, bin Laden sort of dressing down the TTP.
Yeah, exactly.
But just to finish up here a little bit, last question, more related to sort of policy issues. How do you think the presence of the Islamic State now will affect sort of the discourse and possibilities related to the Afghan peace process, as well as American policy decisions about its troop levels, as well as possible departure? And how much do you think the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq and subsequently what has happened since will play into any of this at all?
That's a tough question. It's a tough series of questions.
Yeah, no, I know.
good on you.
They're very big questions,
yeah.
I know.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think anybody necessarily has the answer to it, but it's more just...
No, fair enough. All right, so... I mean, we can already see this playing out somewhat with how it's impacting the process. And so... You know, this week we also saw reports of, you know, the Afghan Taliban or representatives of the Afghan Taliban, you know, stepping aside from the disputes of whether or not they're legitimate representatives of the Afghan Taliban. According to some, they are. According to others, they're not, in terms of participating in negotiations with the Afghan government directly, which is a step that, at least publicly, of what we've known about, has not necessarily taken place before. I think the establishment of Islamic State in Khorasan is a bit of a wake-up call for the Afghan Taliban, as well as the Afghan government, the Pakistani government, as saying, all right, well, there are a lot of challenges in the region, and maybe for the Afghan government, they might not like the Taliban, but recognize that, you know, a negotiated settlement and reconciliation is part of the end game in Afghanistan, which I think a lot of people have recognized for a long time. What exactly that looks like is, you know, devil's in the details. And for the Pakistani government, it's that... it seems that though there's more incentives now for them to actually push for that settlement. And part of this is the sort of thawing of relations between, Afghan's president and the leadership in Pakistan recently. So I think that has helped. I think that the dangerous part of this, though, and I was thinking about this, is, you know, with the rise of, or the establishment of the Islamic State in Khorasan and you know, what that network constitutes, is that, you know, they have the real potential, and I think their main role is for them to play spoiler. And, you know, you've had many groups in the region who have done, you know, things similar, whether it's in Kashmir or, you know, other places. But for, you know, the Afghan Taliban, they're sort of put in a difficult position where it might sort of push them, incentivize them to lean harder and push for negotiations more and to push for a settlement, to satisfy those who, you know, may be suffering from Taliban fatigue, from fatigue of, you know, the years of war and wanting to make more progress and come to some sort of different state of the conflict. But yet there are also other camps within the Afghan Taliban that appear to not support negotiations or reconciliation with the Afghan government. And that's the dangerous piece, I think, because if you have elements that are going to be turned off by negotiations and want to fight anyways and aren't willing to, you know, have those discussions and come to some sort of agreement with the Afghan government, then, and those individuals exist, how powerful they are, I think, is the real question, and how much influence they have. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out with respect to the negotiation process regarding who potentially splits off, and, you know, a natural place that or party that these individuals could join could now be the Islamic State in Khorasan. Now that they don't have to do that, but that is obviously one potential outlet that they could plug into. In terms of U.S. troop levels and, you know, lessons learned from Iraq, obviously there are a lot of differences between Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, of course.
But there are some parallels too. I think that, you know, what's been interesting is to see the administration change its position on, you know, what was a timeline for a complete withdrawal to actually there being a new agreement to maintain troops for a more extended period of time. So I think that there's a recognition within the U.S. government, at least within the current administration, that there needs to be some presence that has capability in Afghanistan for the short to midterm, at least. Because of these types of concerns, and actually to allow there to be a force, whether it's a direct strike force or an advising element that will help the Afghan security forces and the Afghan government to manage some of these problems. And, you know, maybe we could look at the case of the recent strikes as a potential example of what I don't want to describe it as success, because there's a lot to say about what has not been successful about the Afghanistan campaign. But what the future could look like in terms of that cooperation with the U.S., maybe providing more technical expertise with respect to, you know, targeting or drones and those sorts of things, and taking care of elements that actually threaten the state. And if removing some of those individuals helps the reconciliation process, then that's probably a good thing. And I do think that what the Islamic State has done more broadly is it has, you know, unfortunately renormed what it is, you know, what is extreme, and what constitutes, I don't want to say acceptable behavior, but what, that there are different ranges of threats. And it seems as though, you know, one byproduct of all of this might be for, you know, the further we get away from, you know, 9/11 and all of that, is sort of looking at the Taliban and saying, all right, well, maybe people being more open to an integrated political solution than they otherwise would have been in the past.
Yeah, it's definitely a different era in many respects, in many ways, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere in the broader region. Well, thanks for coming on to the show today, Don. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to talking soon.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Aaron.
today's hashtag social media segment, we'll be covering postings from July 11th through the 22nd.
During that time, we saw that four foreign fighters were announced dead with the Islamic State in Iraq, while in Syria, between both Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State, 10 foreign fighters were killed.
During that time, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula announced 19 military operations.
On July 11th, Harakat Ahrar al-Sham al-Islamiyah's social office delivered electric wheelchairs to their disabled members.
On July 12th, Wilayat Hama of the Islamic State graduated their sixth class from the training camp based there.
On July 13th, the Islamic State released a pamphlet on Zakat al-Fitr, a charity given to the poor at the end of the fasting in the month of Ramadan.
On July 13th, Wilayat Tarablus of the Islamic State gave a tour of the milk factory in Sirte.
On July 14th, Kitab Ansar al-Sham's services office built a playground in a refugee camp in Latakia for Eid.
Also on the 14th, Dr. Abdullah Muhammad al-Muhaisini's Mirkaz Duat al-Jihad had a Quranic memorization competition for the students at his center.
The next day, on July 15th, Wilayat Tarablus of the Islamic State put up billboards in the city of Sirte, similar in many ways to ones we've already seen in Syria and in Iraq.
Also on the 15th, Wilayat Farat of the Islamic State is refashioning a bridge that used to be for trains and turning it into a road for cars between the towns of Al-Ramana and Abu Hassan.
On July 15th, Wilayat Al-Raqqa of the Islamic State repairs an underground phone line that's near the services center in Al-Raqqa City.
On July 16th, Wilayat Sinai of the Islamic State passes out foodstuffs to residents in North Sinai.
On the same day, Ansar al-Sharia and Libya's General Services Administration began distributing holiday gifts to children in Benghazi.
Also on the 16th, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State built a new roundabout in Minbij.
On the next day, on July 17th, Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen Darna destroyed a drum of alcohol and arrested those responsible for having it.
Also on the 17th, for security reasons, Jaish al-Fatah and Idlib banned wearing explosive vests in public places.
On July 18th, Dr. Abdullah Muhammad al-Muhaisini's Merkaz Duat al-Jihad graduated its first class from its military training camp called the Cubs of Al-Aqsa to prepare them for the fight against Iran.
On July 19th, the Islamic State released guidelines for Islamic State supporters using the internet.
On July 20th, in Wilayat Dijla of the Islamic State, it opened a new free bus service in the Al Zab district.
On July 21st, Majlis Shura al-Mujahideen Darna denies the Daily Beast's report that it did a Cersei Lannister-style walk of shame for an IS leader it later executed.
On the same day, on July 21st, in rural Hama, Jabhat al-Nusra cleans, decorates, and paints the streets, which is mimicking some of the behavior that we've seen the Islamic State do in territories that it controls.
If you have any feedback about the show, you can email us at podcast@jihadology.net or find us on Twitter where we are at @jihadpod. If you're a fan of the show, please consider taking a moment to rate and review the podcast in iTunes, which will really help more people find the show.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Don for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster, Carl Moran, for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. Until next time, I'm out.